This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Koh, standing in for Aisha Tajuddin.
And this is In Case You Missed It. This week, we'll bring you a collection of stories from Asia Calling.
We start with the first two. Nepal debates secularism, and in India, domestic workers protest for equal rights.
Nepal is in the middle of a constitutional debate on the term secularism. 80% of Nepalese are Hindu, and Nepal was once described as a Hindu kingdom. But as Rajan Parojuli finds, religious minority groups are now questioning if they have religious freedom.
Some 1,000 people are gathering at a popular protest spot in Kathmandu. They are carrying Hindu symbols on flags and banners, chanting, "No secularism, we want Hinduism." 54-year-old Yogmati Karki is among them.
We have largest Hindus in the world. Who will be pinched and who will be hurt if we are a Hindu country?
The word secularism is now being debated in the process of drafting the constitution. Thousands of voters have opted to remove the word secularism from the new constitution. The protest was led by RPP Nepal, the country's fourth largest political party. Kamal Thapa is the president.
Dharma nirpekshata ladiye pachadi dharma parivartan yojana baddha ra sanghatit rupma huna thalyo.
Secularism was accepted as a license and misused to make people convert religion. People were lured, forced, manipulated, and misguided. The number of Christians has reached to hundreds of thousands from handful of people.
But 36-year-old Dheeraj Gautam says that he was not forced by anyone to convert to Christianity.
In my childhood, we were not allowed to go inside the Hindu temple. And I found it's because we are from the lowest caste. Later, I was exposed to Christian, and I like it. I like it from the childhood.
Nepal was once a Hindu kingdom, but it was declared a secular state in 2007 after the success of People's Movement in 2006. Anthropologist Dammar Chemzong says the negative practices of Hinduism drive people to convert to other religions.
Hindus themselves should see or self-evaluate. How does actually, you know, Hinduism classify different groups of population? Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, then untouchables. Five categories in the same caste system. Best humans, humans, less humans, little humans and non-humans, kind of, or dehumanization process is, you know, the whole hierarchy. So people actually seek for liberation from this kind of, you know, exploitative or kind of hierarchical, you know, schema, that kind of strata.
According to 2011 census, 80% of the Nepalese population is Hindu. After Hindu, there are followers of Buddhism, Islam, Christianity and many more. Another protest was held by religious minority groups to declare Nepal a secular state. Around 1,000 people gathered there. One of them is 56-year-old Durga Maharjan, a Buddhist monk carrying a banner to support religious freedom.
We want Hindu and we want Buddha as well. People say, if only Hindu is written in the constitution, we are not allowed to worship Buddha. Buddha is born in our country. We need to save Buddhism. That's why I'm here.
C.B. Gahatras from the National Christian Group says forced conversion is a baseless charge against Christians.
If anyone tries to force other by any means to become Christian, he himself cannot be Christian. It's against the law. The Constitution should ensure right to choose religion for every individual.
Another term being proposed for the new constitution is religious freedom instead of secularism. The draft constitution is now being tabled by the Constituent Assembly. The word secularism has to be endorsed by two-thirds of the members in the Constituent Assembly. Anthropologist Dambar Chemjong says it's important to respect minority groups during the drafting process.
You may be a Hindu, you may be a Buddhist, or you may be a Christian, but as a citizen of a democratic country, I would consider constitution as the, you know, most worshipable. So the state makers' main concern should be how they can draft the constitution, which will be worshipped and which will be, you know, owned by every citizen of the country, all different religious groups, all different cultural groups of the country.
For Asia Calling, this is Rajan Parajuli from Kathmandu.
Now that's an interesting perspective to the secularism debate. Personally, I believe that we can never purely separate religion and the state, perhaps in law, but never in practice. I mean, even America has strong Christian undertones when it comes to lobbying, right? And one of the countries I know successfully practicing secularism is France, but that comes with a long history of distrusting the church and its ideologies.
To me, the state is something that we as citizens collectively have a stake in. But religion is something that is so personal and it's up to an individual to choose. Secularism is not an argument against religion. It's not anti-religious. For the most part, secularists are not against the right of individuals to have a religious faith. What they're opposed to is special treatment for religious beliefs and organizations. Hashtag just saying. Earlier this month, the Indian government submitted a new draft policy on domestic workers. It requires workers to be paid a minimum of $140 a month. It also aims to protect workers from sexual harassment. Workers, however, are protesting the current situation and demanding for action now. Jaswinda Sigal met them to find out why.
Thousands of women domestic workers are gathering near the Albert Museum in the city of Jaipur. They are shouting slogans, "Give us justice, all women are united, give us food, shelter and proper wages." This 26-year-old woman was raped by her employer while working in his kitchen.
I was upset that I left the job. I told my husband about this. You know what my employer did? He registered a case of stealing to the police against me. I resented and raised my voice, but of no use. I was taken to a local police station and I was beaten badly. Now the case is in the court. Nobody is there to help me.
According to the International Labour Organization, India has nearly 5 million domestic workers. More than 80% are women working under poor conditions. Meva Bharati is the organizer of the rally.
The main issues are lack of facilities at the workplace, improper residential arrangements, uncertain wages, no holidays, and lack of medical facilities. If any of us gets injured at the workplace, the employer nor the government provides us treatment.
India has laws for social security, sexual harassment and minimum wages for domestic workers. But the government is struggling in locating the workers. Activist Kavita Srivastava says it's crucial to have clear database of the workers.
Imagine living in a city without an identity card. You will be the butt of the police, you know, the police is going to take you first. Today, one of the major demands is 100% registration of all the domestic workers under this law.
The new policy draft gives hope to thousands of poor workers across the country. Bandaru Dattatreya is India's labor minister.
The priority of my government is to strengthen the domestic workers.
We have already started adopting social security measures for them. We have started issuing them universal account numbers for their provident funds.
Once the law is there, employers must provide health insurance, weekly and maternal leaves, and pension funds for the workers. An employer will have to hire only through placement agencies. The draft will be discussed in the cabinet soon, and then parliament. It's still a long way to go. Back at the protest, 80-year-old Roma Sen says she couldn't wait any longer.
I've been working as a domestic worker for the past 20 years. I'm old and my employers are not happy with my work. They want to get rid of me. Tell me, where should I go? What should I do?
For Asia Calling, this is Jaswinder Sehgal in Jaipur, India.
Now, as if according to India's Statistics Ministry, there are approximately 4.2 million domestic workers in the country. There isn't any reliable statistics to determine the exact number of workers in the sector. What's worst is that right now there are no formal contracts ensuring an employer-employee relationship. On top of that, their wages are determined by arbitrary factors like tasks performed. It's shocking.
Sounds horrible.
It is.
And I think, you know, that's the problem with migration in general. There's this lack of proper documentation and the problem is more complex than we can imagine. I mean, for one, for the migrants to come to work in other countries, such as Malaysia, for example, they have to pay agents and sometimes they get cheated and are forced to repay quite a hefty sum and have their documents held ransom. And it doesn't help that an unkind law doesn't really side with them. So they are a disenfranchised community and hence why employers won't really think twice about giving them the bare economic or, you know, humane minimum. After the break, we continue our travels across Asia with some selection of Asia Calling stories. I'm Azhar Fazuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is, in case you missed it, I'm Azhar Fazuddin.
And I'm Cheryl Kaur.
We continue our curation of stories from Asia Calling. Now, let's head over to Indonesia.
Yulianus Rito Blaut is the first female transgender with a master's degree in Indonesia, where most transgenders end up working as prostitutes without proper education. Her thesis on the need for homes for all transgender individuals was awarded as the best thesis. Rebecca Henschke met Yulianus and had a look at her project.
They were walking down a dirt road up to a very small pink house at the end of the alleyway in a very suburban area of Jakarta, on the outskirts of Jakarta. There's chickens running around and children playing, a dusty road. And it's in this small pink house that's being built, Indonesia's first old people's home for transsexuals, transgender people known here in Indonesia as waria.
Selamat pagi.
In the doorway, two elderly transgender whose teeth are missing call out good morning. Inside, Yulianus Rita Blaut is looking into a mirror while a friend is going through the daily ritual of applying her heavy makeup. Thick white foundation, fake eyelashes, bright red lipstick, and a long black wig that is tied into a bun at the back.
Saya sendiri mengetahui saya waria itu sekitar saya kelas 5 SD. Dalam arti bahwa saya
I realized that I was a transgender when I was in grade 5 at school. I lived in a village in an isolated area on the island of Papua. There was no one there that was a transgender or gay. But suddenly I started feeling attracted to men when I was around 11 years old. I thought, what is this feeling? Is it an illness? It was not till I was 18 years old when a friend at university who was also transgender took me to Jakarta to the prostitution beat for waria that I realized that there was this whole other world that existed. I was so confused. There were so many people like me, dressed up so beautifully.
How did you feel when you realized you were not alone?
I felt like a weight had been lifted from me, because I saw that if we wear beautiful clothes and put on makeup, you could easily attract guys and be paid money for it. So you get satisfied, get to be beautiful, and you earn money.
Jobs aren't easy to come by in Indonesia if you're living as a woman in a man's body. And 17-year-old Yuli ended up doing what many other warriors do, working as a prostitute on the streets, a world she says was harsh and violent. Yuli said she was regularly abused and not paid by customers, and they had to run away from the police or Islamic vigilante groups that tried to beat them. It was during this time that she heard her parents had died.
They had heard news that I was now wearing women's clothes. I think I disappointed them so much that it killed them. I didn't go home for the funeral because my family hated me. They said because of what I had done, my parents had died. My brother is a policeman. He was very angry and he wanted to shoot me because he said I had shamed my family. They said in our family, we have never had anyone like you. How could you turn out like this? Because my family had high hopes for me because I got very good grades all through school.
Your brother really tried to shoot you?
Yes, he put a pistol to my head and he wanted to shoot. They shaved my head, but I managed to run away back to Jakarta. I really hated myself at that time and I decided that I would spend the rest of my life showing the world, and particularly my family, that even though I am transgender, I could do good and they could be proud of me.
She went on to be the first warrior to gain a law degree at a leading Islamic university and is now doing her master's in law. She's a high-profile leader of Indonesia's large transgender community, who fondly call her Mummy Yuli. As a mother to the community, she's decided she needs to do something to support aging warrior, rejected by their family and society.
As they get older, people become even more scared of warrior, and we can't sell ourselves in the same way young warrior can. From a government perspective, they are confused about whether to put them in the male or female old people's home, and their families certainly don't want to look after them. So I see many of them struggling, begging on the streets and living under bridges. I feel really sad seeing them like that, and no one is paying attention to this issue, and my house was not big enough to house many.
So she's now renovating her two-bedroom house that also doubles as a beauty salon. Yuli takes me out the back of the house where building is taking place. A second floor is being put on and the bathroom is being extended. She already has a waiting list of 800 warrior who want to move in. At the moment, the house is home to three elderly warrior. Photos of them as young, beautiful models line the walls and the cabinets are full of their beauty pageant trophies. Yoti Maya is nearly 70 years old and has lost all her teeth. She was disowned by her family when she was a teenager.
My mother opened my door and found me in bed cuddling with a man, and she told my dad, and he called all my family together and said, I don't want this in my family, so you must leave the house now. If you live or die, I don't care. You just have to get out of the house. I was just a teenager and they threw me out of the house at night with nothing but the clothes I was wearing. I was crying. I was young and I didn't have a job, but I accepted my fate.
Yoti eventually found work as a chef on ships and travelled across Asia. She's now the cook for the nursing home. The home also holds training sessions for elderly transgender so that they can get skills to live independently. Recently, Yuli's brother, who had threatened to shoot her, visited the old people's home and saw what was happening there.
Dan dia tidak masuk dan mengelilingi pekarangan rumah ini dan
he did not come in but just walked around and he started to cry. He said, I never thought you would change and become a good person. It doesn't matter that you are a warrior, but you have become a role model for your community and you are providing a home for those in your community in need. Our family is very proud of you. He said, we couldn't accept you as a prostitute, but you have become a good person.
Terus dia bilang bahwa yang sudah terjadi, tapi
he said that the past was the past, but as a brother, I'm very proud of you. A few days later, I had my law graduation. He came along. He couldn't say anything at the celebration. He came along. He couldn't speak because he was just crying. Not long after that, he died. I went to his funeral and he had left a message for me that I must continue to be a good person.
Kemudian cuma titip pesan bahwa aku harus jadi orang baik. Itu seperti itu.
Now, as if discrimination against transgenders is rife here in Malaysia too. The Human Rights Watch published a report last year on the human rights abuse transgender people in Malaysia face. The report features first-hand accounts of the mistreatment and abuse they go through, and honestly, it's heart-wrenching. Transphobia is on the rise here in Malaysia, and it's evident following the assault on LGBT activist Nisha Ayub last month.
Exactly, and if you look at the recent ruling where transgender aren't allowed to cross-dress as they usually would, it's also another indication.
Yeah, and that was the ruling in Negeri Sembilan. It was the Sharia court ruling, which says that, like you said, transgender women are not allowed to cross-dress.
Exactly. And to go back to the story, though, which Asia Calling produced for us, that was quite a bittersweet ending, don't you think? I mean, Yuli, the transgender individual, has been facing discrimination her whole life, but more painfully, her family. And I think that's a very difficult part for most people, is that fine, people outside the family are okay, but when your family member threatens to shoot you in the head for being transgender, that's quite a heavy thing. But you know, the fact that she transcended those challenges and that her brother finally, after decades, validated her, that must have been quite cathartic. And this project of hers to shelter the elderly transgender is commendable. I mean, it's just one of the many proofs that it isn't who you are, it's what you do that defines you as an individual.
Exactly.
Two most wanted suspects have been arrested 4 years after a Filipino radio activist and prominent environmentalist was murdered. Former Palawan Governor Joel Reyes and his brother Mario fled the country after they were implicated in the murder of Gerardo Ortega. The trial is about to start, but Ortega's family fears they won't get the justice given the suspects are wealthy and influential. Jafel Tesserio and Ariel Carlos report from Palawan.
Joel and Mario Reyes arrived in Palawan, handcuffed and escorted by police. Joel is the former Palawan governor, while Mario was the former town mayor of Coron. The two men are suspected of murdering journalist and environmentalist Gerardo Ortega, a claim Joel denied to the press.
The reason we came home is because we want to ask the court for a fast resolution of the case so we can put an end to this story, so that real justice can be achieved not only by us but also by Ortega family.
Ortega was critical of Joel Reyes when he was governor, accusing him of pocketing millions of pesos from a natural gas project and mining activities in Palawan. After Ortega was murdered in 2011, the Reyes brothers left the country. Branded as wanted fugitives, the government put a bounty of $50,000 each for their capture. Reyes says they have long wanted to return home, but the government canceled their passports.
I don't want to go home as a dead man. The people of Palawan have loved me and they know me, and they know that I never would have done what I am accused of. We will put that in court now.
Reyes claims they fled not because they were guilty, but because they feared for their lives. He says the charges are political and they were framed, but the Ortega family believes otherwise, claiming all evidence points to the Reyes brothers.
Oh my God!
Patty Ortega is the widow of the victim.
We will not stop fighting this. And I think that our judiciary system is fair enough to let this proceed in court. That is what I'm hoping for and I'm praying for.
The Reyes brothers are facing charges of murder, and despite their previous positions, the Justice Department says there will be no special treatment. But Patty Ortega is worried the case might be dismissed by a mere technicality.
We have to fight for this. Since the beginning, only the gunman are convicted, not the mastermind. We have to fight for justice. No, we don't want the culture of impunity will go on.
Impunity is a regular feature in all media killings in the Philippines. Activists say journalists continue to be murdered as the government lacks political will to thoroughly investigate. Redempto Anda, a member of the Filipino National Union for Journalists, says the case has to continue.
This case has already dragged on for so long, actually.
There are a lot of intervening legal issues that have hampered the progress of the case to resolution. Right now, the issue is actually in a very early stage, and it's very early stage right after preliminary investigation. Just because the defense, the lawyers of Governor Reyes, aren't even dealing with the merits of the evidence. They want to avoid trial.
Anda says there is a high chance of conviction because the gunmen and other involved in planning the murder confessed the Reyes brothers hired them. However, the lawyer for the Reyes brothers says his clients have been unjustly maligned.
The most pressing issue is the negative impression of people arising from what happened in the past 2 or 3 years, because people think that a person charged is already a person guilty. And that does not work under our system of law, because a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. However, the common law will look at it like guilty na in Reyes brothers because of the publicity that has been hounding them.
There are also speculations about the timing of the arrest just before elections next year. Some have speculated the Reyes brothers may even try and run for office if they are cleared of wrongdoing. For now, though, the government has instructed prosecutors to ensure the brothers are behind bars during the trial. With Jofel Tesorio from Palawan, Philippines, this is Ariel Carlos for Asia Calling.
You know, Cheryl, I think this problem pretty much exists everywhere, where individuals or whistleblowers who attempt to uncover wrongdoings meet an untimely death. Think of our very own case of Teo Benghok, where he died while he was under MEC's questioning. The fact that he jumped off a building, and to this very day, we don't even know what happened, what transpired. And more worrying is the fact that those responsible get away because of legal loophole, because there's not enough evidence to kind of back up motives and stuff. So this probably doesn't happen all the time, but it happens enough so that the truth is never brought to light or generally left to speculation.
As if I did some research, and it turns out that according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 44 journalists have been killed so far this year.
That's a high number.
Mm-hmm. And the breakdown shows that journalists reporting on politics were top of the list, followed by those reporting on human rights and war. France had the highest number of journalists killed this year due to the Charlie Hebdo massacre.
And I think you can categorize that probably under cultural, I guess, in some sense of the word. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. In Case You Missed It, was produced by Cheryl Kaur, Hanif Baharuddin, and myself, Azif Azuddin.
I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9,
The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.